This is Lecture 8 in the series Essentials of Capitalism. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. As I open my last lecture in this series, I have to say that I cannot deliver it with the sense that it marks a logical summing up and culmination of the preceding 7 lectures. It is simply an 8th lecture in what needs to be a considerably larger series in order to convey a sense of completeness and the satisfaction of having surveyed an entire self-contained area of thought. So when I conclude today, I will admittedly be concluding somewhere in the middle. I will be concluding after having covered many major topics, such as freedom and saving, only lightly, and others, such as monopoly, not at all. These are all subjects I would certainly like to cover in depth, but will have to do so on another occasion. This morning, I am simply going to forge ahead with a discussion of 2 further matters closely related to the subject of competition, namely the population question and the freedom of immigration. Allow me to begin. With the notable exceptions of Adam Smith and Frederick Bastiat, the classical economists taught, in sympathy with Malthus, that population growth represents a threat to the average standard of living. As I explained in Lecture 4, in connection with our discussion of private ownership of land and land rent, their belief was that the larger the number of people, the larger the number and poorer the quality of the acres of land and deposits of minerals that must be worked to support them. And at the same time, the more intensive the exploitation of each acre and deposit worked, resulting in diminishing returns. For both reasons, they held, the increases in population and in the number of workers tend to be accompanied by less than proportionate increases in the supply of food and minerals. The clear implication of this doctrine is that there is an inherent conflict of interests among people as their numbers increase. It is tantamount to the claim that man is in the position of the lions in the jungle after all. The lions are at the point of a scarcity of food supply. Man allegedly approaches it with every increase in his numbers. Indeed, Malthus was the inspiration for Darwin, whose writings were in turn the inspiration for the idea of conflict in the more naked form known as social Darwinism. A garbled form of Malthusianism is a root of the ecology movement's hostility to population growth. The fact is, however, that the classical economists' ideas on the effects of population growth are valid only for a stagnant non-division of labor society. There, everyone lives in the same way as everyone else, as a self-sufficient farmer. There, the existence of more people does mean the need for more and more land of progressively inferior quality and an ever-worsening problem of diminishing returns. There, it does mean the need to start farms higher and higher up the sides of hills or mountains, to extend farming to rockier patches of soil, or down into marshlands, and to subdivide existing farms among more and more people, all with the result of declining yields per unit of labor expended. But this is not at all what the existence of more people means in a division of labor society. In a division of labor society, a larger population means a greater, more intensive division of labor. Adam Smith alluded to this fact when he wrote, quote, "The division of labor is limited by the extent of the market," unquote. The meaning of this proposition is that the extent to which the division of labor can be carried in the production of anything depends on the volume in which it is to be produced. If, for example, automobiles are to be turned out, say, 10 or 20 a day in a given location, then it is impossible that a step which takes 5 minutes to perform on any one car could be anyone's full-time job. The daily volume of automobile production would have to be increased to approximately 100 in a given location before such an operation could be made into a full-time job. Their daily volume would have to be increased to approximately 1,000 in a given location before an operation requiring only 30 seconds could be made into a full-time job, and so on. Thus, the larger the volume to be produced, the larger the market to be served, the further can the division of labor be carried. Markets, however, are not made possible by non-producing consumers, as Adam Smith well knew, but only by producers. And without more producers overall, a more intensive division of labor in the production of any one good would require drawing labor away from the production of other goods, and thus correspondingly reducing the extent of division of labor elsewhere. The only way to have a greater division of labor overall is by virtue of a larger population of producers. This alone permits the division of labor to be extended in some areas without being correspondingly reduced in other areas. So when we speak of the connection between the division of labor and population, or the division of labor and markets, let us always keep in mind that we are talking about a larger population of producers, and of overall markets that are larger by virtue of the existence of more producers. Keeping this in mind, let us consider some further illustrations of the connection between the division of labor and the size of the population. Consider, for example, why large cities have so many specialized shops and restaurants, which are rarely found elsewhere, and never in any great variety anywhere else. The reason is that the large population of such a city constitutes so vast a market that the statistically most infrequent tastes and interests are present in a great enough absolute quantity to make their accommodation possible. For example, on any given evening, perhaps only one person in 10,000 would like to eat Indian food. If the whole surrounding territory has only 50,000 inhabitants, such a restaurant almost certainly cannot survive. Its survival in such conditions would require patrons willing to pay extremely high prices. Only then could it be worthwhile for anyone to operate such an establishment. But in a large city or metropolitan area, with a surrounding population of 10 million, say, there will be 1,000 people, on average, wanting to eat such food every evening. As a result, several such restaurants can exist and prosper. The same principle applies to specialized bookstores, equipment stores, and so on. It also explains why it is in large cities that one finds such cultural institutions as museums, opera companies, symphony orchestras, and so on, which appeal to refined, and in terms of their frequency of occurrence, relatively uncommon tastes. Only large cities have a sufficiently large market to provide a sufficient level of attendance for such institutions. We can observe the advantages of a large population by considering the size of the population necessary for the existence of an economical size medical school, say, and then for the existence of medical specializations. Everything we observe here will apply throughout the economic system. Let us assume that an efficient-sized medical school produces 100 new doctors per year. This number, let us assume, is a number that represents enough students to keep the cost of lectures and demonstrations within reason on a per-student basis, and yet not so many students that they cannot obtain sufficient individual consultations and so forth with the faculty. What the actual number of graduates of an efficient-sized medical school really is, I don't know. The figure of 100 is purely hypothetical. Let us assume further that the average graduate of this medical school will practice medicine for 40 years after graduation. This means that ultimately there will be 4,000 graduates of this school in practice at any one time. Finally, let us assume that the average frequency of diseases and accidents and so on that require medical attention is such that in order to keep the average doctor more or less fully occupied, there has to be 1,000 people for every doctor. Well, this implies that a population of 4 million is necessary to provide a market large enough to support one efficient-sized medical school. But this is by no means the end. For suppose that only one doctor in 1,000 is a brain specialist. With a total of only 4,000 doctors, there would be only 4 brain specialists. That is hardly enough to support a journal of brain diseases, to make possible special graduate programs or seminars in brain diseases, and so on. A population of 4,000 brain specialists, however, would make these things possible. But that implies a market constituted not by 4 million, but by 4 billion people. This same kind of radical step up in the size of the market necessary to make further specialization possible occurs throughout production. Let's go back to the case of automobile production, where I pointed out that for a full-time job to be made out of one specific step that requires 30 seconds per car, Volume would have to be approximately 1,000 cars per day in a given location. Well, suppose that that is the volume, but that the worker doing this job could be helped by a machine specifically designed for that purpose. If the total market for automobiles is limited to 1,000 per day, then there is room for only one such machine. Obviously, it would be impossible to have any regular employment in producing such machines. But suppose the market for automobiles is not 1,000 per day, but 50,000 per day, so that 50 such machines are required. Now, it is probably possible to have some people regularly employed just in the production of these machines, who will produce them with greater experience and expertise. Of course, their division of labor cannot go very far. If there is a specific operation in building the machine which takes an hour, say, that operation can certainly not be anyone's full-time job, because it occurs so infrequently. A vastly larger market would be required to carry the division of labor to the point where even fairly large-size specific steps in the production of these machines could be made into full-time jobs. It is doubtful if we could ever achieve markets so large that we would exhaust all possibilities for carrying the division of labor further in the production of specialized machines and tools. Now, it is necessary to realize how important are the gains a larger market provides, not only in allowing the existence of further specializations and subspecializations, but also simply in allowing existing specializations and subspecializations to be carried on a larger absolute scale. Our medical school example can illustrate this point. Some kind of very small market, say a few hundred people, is necessary to allow one person to specialize as some sort of primitive doctor. A larger market of several millions that permits the existence of several thousand doctors also permits them all to be trained in a medical school and creates the subspecialization of brain specialist. A still larger market increases the absolute number of brain specialists, and here we can easily see something that is vitally important. Namely, if the market is big enough to support 400 or better still 4,000 brain specialists rather than just 4, the likelihood of some important discovery being made about brain diseases is substantially increased. For there will be 400 or 4,000 highly intelligent and experienced people thinking about the problems involved instead of just 4. And whatever any one of them discovers can, of course, be quickly communicated to all the rest, through the journals, seminars, and so on, that their number is large enough to support. Again, exactly the same principle applies throughout production. The larger the size of the market, the greater is not only the number of the scientific and engineering specializations and subspecializations, but also the absolute size of all of them. And equally important, the larger the absolute number of innovative individuals prepared to go into the various lines of business. Thus, throughout the economic system, the chances of new discoveries and inventions being made and implemented and quickly communicated throughout the fields concerned are greatly increased, and thus the rate of economic progress accelerates. The potential gains of this kind from a larger sized population in a division of labor society can be thought of in terms of a doubled population having a doubled number of Edisons and Fords and so on. A doubled population, even with 1.1 times the number of such innovators, is easily capable of overcoming any problems of diminishing returns and poorer quality land and mineral deposits through technological progress, and of doing so by an ever-widening margin. The existence of each additional productive genius serves to raise the productive power of the whole human race, because essentially what he supplies is ideas. Ideas can be used by everyone who has need of them without in any way diminishing their ability to serve others. They are an inexhaustible gift. What we have here in the existence of a larger population in a division of labor society is a further step up in productive power along the lines of the multiplication of knowledge used in production and the raising of the level of such knowledge to a standard set by the most intelligent. For now we have a larger absolute number of the most intelligent, which is bound to mean a more rapidly rising standard of knowledge used in production. The fact that a larger market provides important gains in the form of a more intensive division of labor and a larger absolute size of the various specializations and subspecializations implies the desirability of worldwide free trade. Under worldwide free trade, every producer could regard the entire world as his market. Production could be carried on in each locality on the vastly greater scale commensurate with a world market. Thus, the division of labor could reach its maximum possible intensivity, consistent with the existing size of the world's population and the proportion of it already incorporated into the division of labor within the various national boundaries. One may believe that already, even with substantial trade barriers, the scientific and engineering professions of all the various countries are essentially integrated, and that knowledge flows freely among them. With the exception, of course, of the communist and other totalitarian countries. This is probably true. But what cannot flow freely, so long as there are trade barriers, is the implementation of scientific and technological progress in the form of improvements in products and methods of production. If we want that, we need access to all the business talent to be found in the world, which means we need to establish the right of every businessman everywhere to sell us his goods. So long as that is missing, the benefit of the existence of much business talent is largely lost, because it is simply kept out by tariffs and other trade barriers. We are simply deprived of the benefit of the existence of talented foreign businessmen. And, of course, we are deprived of the benefit of all the economies of larger scale production that free trade would make possible. The gains from free trade and the consequent access to a larger market can be illustrated by comparing the economic history of the United States with that of Western Europe. The fact that there is free trade among the various states has made the United States into the largest free trade area in the world in terms of population. Because of its substantially greater population than any single West European country, American businessmen were able to produce on a larger scale, with greater division of labor and more efficiency than their West European counterparts. A businessman anywhere in the United States could regard the whole territory and population of the United States as his market, and businesses were able to be built up accordingly. In Europe, on the other hand, tariffs and other trade barriers increasingly tended to restrict the markets of businessmen to the much smaller territories and populations of their respective countries. By the same token, the American people had free access to the greater absolute volume of business talent to be found among its own greater population, while the people of most European countries were increasingly confined to the smaller absolute volume of business talent to be found among their smaller populations. These facts help to explain the more rapid rate of economic progress that prevailed in the United States than in Western Europe until fairly recently. The fact that in recent decades, West European countries have greatly reduced their tariffs and other trade barriers against one another under the aegis of the common market has contributed to their rapid rate of economic progress in this period. Now, to a substantial degree, businessmen in any one member country can regard the populations of all the rest as part of his market. The combined population of these countries, incidentally, counting that of the newer members, somewhat exceeds the population of the United States. The result has been an intensification of the division of labor within Western Europe, and a much greater ability of the citizens of each member country to gain access to the talents of businessmen in the other member countries. The advantages of the United States from internal free trade and the gains derived from freer trade within Western Europe would be dwarfed by those derived from fully free trade on a world basis. But free foreign trade ultimately requires a policy of laissez-faire domestically. We have seen how government interference in the labor market causes free trade to result in mass unemployment, which leads to the abandonment of free trade. Similarly, government subsidy programs are incompatible with free trade. A government cannot, for example, try to raise the price of wheat in its country above the world market level, and at the same time allow the free importation of foreign wheat. Some economists have held that external free trade is compatible with government intervention domestically if governments abandon much of their political sovereignty to a supranational authority which would impose a uniform policy of intervention. For example, the problem of wheat subsidies could be solved, it is held, if all countries in the trading area had the same subsidy program. To some degree, the European Common Market represents a relinquishing of national sovereignty to the organs of the common market. The ultimate success of the common market is thought to rest on the prospects for the political unification of Western Europe. However, no uniform policy of government intervention can deal with such matters as the major differences between the productivity of labor in different areas. A uniform minimum wage between the United States and Taiwan, for example, would mean the virtually total destruction of the Taiwanese economy if it were set at the level now prevailing in the United States, and its nullification in the United States if it were set at the level of wage rates for unskilled labor now prevailing in Taiwan. Furthermore, the long-run effect of government intervention is to break up the unity of existing political entities, not to promote the formation of still larger political entities. For the existence of government intervention is an invitation to pressure group warfare. Groups form to use the government as an instrument serving their short-run interests at the expense of the interests of the rest of society. In such an environment, such groups often come to be formed on the basis of such factors as regional ties, ethnic origin, and common language. Each such special group feels the need to control the use of government power in order to promote its own interests at the expense of other groups, and to protect itself from the depredations of other groups. In such conditions, growing conflict and hostility develop among the various groups, culminating in violent clashes and ultimately in demands for political separation. Thus, at the very same time that some people are calling for a United States of Europe, others are demanding the breakup of the existing countries of Europe. In Great Britain, there are the Scottish and Welsh nationalists, in Spain, the Basque separatists, in Belgium, the Flemish separatists, and in other countries, other such groups. Thus, international free trade and the gains to be derived from the international division of labor ultimately require the existence of domestic free trade, of laissez-faire capitalism. We have established that in a division of labor society, a larger size population, far from reducing the average standard of living, actually increases it. This demonstration by no means implies, however, that the ideal arrangement would be the highest possible birth rate, or that birth control measures operate to hold down the standard of living. There is an important difference between a large-sized existing population, made up of self-supporting adults, and a rapidly growing population, composed of a high proportion of dependent children. Under modern conditions, rapid population growth, achieved by means of a high birth rate, represents a reduction in the standard of living of those who must support the children. It did not have to mean that earlier in our history, when children performed labor on their parents' farms from an early age, but it does in conditions in which parents want to give their children the advantages of a prolonged education, and in which the children cannot be self-supporting for perhaps 18 to 25 years. Too rapid population growth caused by a too high birth rate is almost impossible, however, in a society which is not dominated by religious mysticism and in which parents are financially responsible for the costs of raising their own children. For then, the parents simply consider the cost they will have to bear and act accordingly. The only way a problem of population growth can be created in these circumstances is insofar as the government taxes the general public to pay for the costs of raising children. Then people can have children at little or no cost to themselves, and the bill is sent to the taxpayers. Welfare allowances geared to family size, so-called family assistance allowances, and public education are examples of measures of this type. I want to address the issue of free immigration. I believe that free immigration is to the long-run material self-interest of the people of a capitalist country. I have to stress that I am talking about a capitalist country. If a country has a welfare system, tax-supported hospitals and schools, public housing and so on, and the immigrants come to take advantage of these offerings, the effect is a dead loss to the present inhabitants of the country, who have to pay the costs. So I am talking about a country without such things, a country in which the immigrants must be fully self-supporting and themselves pay for whatever they receive. I am also talking about a country which places absolutely no economic disabilities on immigrants, neither direct nor indirect. That is, a country without minimum wage laws, pro-union legislation, or any other legal obstacle to the immigrants gaining employment, starting businesses, buying land, and so on. Under such conditions, the freedom of immigration must ultimately prove economically beneficial to everyone, because among the immigrants and among their descendants will be individuals of great talent, capable of achieving great things in a free country, but who would be stifled and be able to contribute little or nothing in the lands of their origin. In effect, the freedom of immigration into a free country from countries that are less free or unfree is a vital means of unlocking human talent and increasing the gains from the pyramid of ability. As one very simple example, let us ask ourselves what would have been the effect on Andrew Carnegie, and not just on the American, but on the world steel industry, if he had been prevented from immigrating to the United States and confined to the less free environment of Scotland and Great Britain. What would have been the effect on the development of the helicopter if Sikorsky had been prevented from immigrating to the United States from Russia? Is it likely that the Russians would have seen the value of his ideas before they had been proved by actual repeated demonstration in the United States? We should consider the effects if the ancestors of any American industrial innovator had had to remain in their native lands, and that person had been born and spent his life in a country like Italy, Poland, Russia, or Germany, or even France or Great Britain, instead of the United States. Probably most of the innovators would have been stifled, or at least significantly held back. The historical advantage I spoke of earlier, of the people of the United States having access to more business talent than the people of any European country, that was due to our policy of free immigration in combination with our generally greater economic freedom. This not only gave us a larger population from which to draw such talent, but ensured that in the larger population a greater frequency of such talent would be manifested. The combination of free immigration and general economic freedom thus results both in more people and, as an inextricable part of the same process, a more rapid rate of economic progress at the same time. Simply put, free immigration into a free country accelerates economic progress because talent requires freedom in order to flourish. It brings talent to freedom, and so enables more of it to flourish and contribute to economic progress. The acceleration of economic progress it achieves ultimately far outstrips whatever short-run problems may accompany an increase in immigration. I want to refute the arguments advanced against the freedom of immigration and the population growth it causes. 1. It is claimed that the larger population resulting from free immigration creates the need to resort to inferior grades of land and mineral deposits and is accompanied by diminishing returns. I have already answered this argument in connection with my discussion of population growth and private ownership of land. Here, I will only add an additional criticism that applies particularly when the population growth results from immigration. And that is that the immigration can be accompanied by the importation of additional raw materials along with the additional people. Imagine, for example, that the workers of the British steel industry migrated to the United States and became steel workers here. This would not mean that the iron ore they require must be taken from the Mesabi Range in Minnesota. Very probably, it would simply mean that iron ore that used to go from Labrador to Britain will now go from Labrador to the United States. This example, I think, points up the fact that those who fear population growth are thinking in terms of a non-division of labor society in which people work the land and in which more people in a territory means more working of the land in that territory. Actually, immigration into towns and cities has no necessary connection with the extent to which the land and mineral deposits of the surrounding territory must be worked, because the towns and cities can draw their raw materials from anywhere in the world. The notion that more people in a country must mean a higher ratio of labor to land in that country simply does not apply in a division of labor society. 2. It is claimed that a larger population must reduce the productivity of labor because it means a higher ratio of labor to capital goods, or what is the same thing, less capital goods per worker. Those who advance this argument believe that population growth and increases in the supply of capital goods are independent processes. Capital accumulation, they believe, is determined simply by saving, which allegedly has no connection with the growth of population. Now, the fact is that a larger labor force is itself the cause of a larger supply of capital goods. A larger labor force, together even with an unchanged supply of capital goods, results in an increase in total production. This no one can deny. It is only necessary to realize that what is produced in an economy is not only consumers' goods, but also capital goods. As I explained in Lecture 3, labor and existing capital goods are used to produce both consumers' goods and capital goods, in accordance with the relative demands for the two types of goods. The implication of this is that if there is any single, one-shot increase in the labor force, it automatically tends to be followed by a growth in capital goods per worker, and thus in output per worker, at least back to their original levels. For the larger labor force produces more capital goods with which that same labor force then works in the next period, and with the aid of which it enjoys a higher productivity. The further effect is another increase in production in the following period, both of consumers' goods and of capital goods, until the original levels of capital goods per worker and the productivity of labor are equaled and surpassed. It should be clear that no reasonable case exists against any single dose of immigration or population increase based on the argument that it reduces the amount of capital goods per worker, for the additional labor results in progressively more capital goods. Does the reduced capital per worker argument against immigration and population growth fare better against a continuous increase in the labor force? Here, it could be argued that just as the first group of additional workers brings about an increase in the supply of capital goods, a second group arrives on the scene, so that the ratio of capital goods to labor does not increase and may even fall further. Even this more sophisticated argument cannot stand, because if the productivity of labor were threatened by a relative excess of labor and a relative deficiency of capital goods, the effect would be a drop in the demand for labor, and thus in the workers' demand for consumers' goods, and a rise in the demand for capital goods. The effect of this would be a higher relative production of capital goods and a lower relative production of consumers' goods. The larger labor force of each period would find sufficient additional capital goods available because they would be produced by a larger proportion of the labor force and capital goods of the previous periods, as well as by a growing volume of labor and capital goods from period to period. And as time went on, the positive effects I described of the unlocking of more human talent would occur. The effect of this would be an increase in the output of capital goods, or consumers' goods, that can be obtained from any given quantity of labor working in conjunction with any given quantity of capital goods. As I explained in Lecture 3, the effect of this in turn would be a more rapid rate of increase in the production both of capital goods and of consumers' goods, with each period's larger output of capital goods serving as the base for the following period's further increase in the production both of capital goods and of consumers' goods. Thus, a capitalist economy with the freedom of immigration turns out to have a more rapid rate of capital accumulation than one without it, for it has both a larger relative production of capital goods and uses capital goods more efficiently in the further production of capital goods than one without the freedom of immigration. The effect of its more rapid rate of capital accumulation is a correspondingly faster rate of economic progress, which soon makes up for the reduction in the proportion of output going to the consumption of wage earners. If one wants to form a more precise, quantitative estimate of the relationships involved, let us assume that free immigration, together with any increase in the population of those already present, results in an overall rate of population growth of 3% per year. This is a rate last seen in colonial times. It would be sufficient to double the population every 25 years. In order for a 3% larger number of workers each year to be as well equipped as the workers would be without population increase, something on the order, perhaps, of an additional 9 to 12% of national income would need to be devoted to saving and capital accumulation. This figure is generous. I arrive at it on the basis of the fact that in the 19th century and the first few decades of the 20th century, the period in which the American economy was relatively free, the long-term historical ratio of reproducible capital to national income was about 3 or 4 to 1. Thus, a 3% increase in capital to accompany the 3% increase in the number of workers, and so maintain a 3 or 4 to 1 ratio of capital to output per worker, would represent no more than something on the order of 9 to 12% of national income, in conditions in which the degree of capital intensiveness was substantially higher than it is today. Having to obtain this 9 to 12% of national income from the share of national income previously going to wage earners would represent something on the order of a one-time reduction in wages of about 13 to 17%, if, as is typical, wages initially constitute about 70% of national income. This magnitude of reduction in wages, however, greatly overstates the magnitude that would actually follow the establishment of free immigration. This is because it is predicated on going from zero population increase to an annual rate of 3% increase. In reality, the effect would be more likely to be to go from a 1.5% annual increase without freedom of immigration to perhaps a 3% annual increase with it. The additional capital required would thus actually equal only 4.5 to 6% of national income rather than 9 to 12%, and the one-time wage reduction would be on the order of 6.5 to 8.5% rather than 13 to 17%. If the freedom of immigration were introduced following the establishment of greater economic freedom in other respects, this short-run negative effect would probably go largely unperceived, since it would be more than offset by other positive developments. But in any case, if the effect of the freedom of immigration and the pool of talent it unlocks is to enable the productivity of labor to increase by just an additional 1% a year, then as soon as this happens, within a scant 6 years, the initial loss is made good, and thereafter the process results only in gains. A third argument raised against the freedom of immigration is that its effect would be to reduce the wages of unskilled workers relative to those of skilled workers. This result would occur to the extent that such factors as their lack of knowledge of the language and the possibly lower educational standards of the poorer countries from which they came led the immigrants to enter the economic system more heavily at the unskilled end of the labor market than at the skilled end. Now, this argument could have weight only if its supporters could show that the influx of unskilled workers substantially added to the short-run drop in the standard of living of the present unskilled workers over and above the drop we have just discussed. This cannot be shown because by the time the influx of immigrants is able to have a significant depressing effect on the relative wages of unskilled workers, it also exerts a significant positive effect on the absolute standard of living of everyone. Consider, if the freedom of immigration means an additional increase in the labor force of about 1.5% a year, then whatever the proportions of skilled and unskilled labor among the immigrants, in any one year, it can change the proportion among the labor force as a whole only very slightly. As a hypothetical illustration, if initially half the labor force is skilled and half unskilled, while among the immigrants only 1/3 are skilled and 2/3 are unskilled, the effect in 1 year is to change the overall composition of the labor force to a little more than 49.75% skilled and a little less than 50.25% unskilled. Furthermore, this change in the relative composition of the labor force does not go on indefinitely, because as time passes, more and more of the earlier immigrants move up the ladder into skilled jobs. And in the generation of their children, the proportion of skilled and unskilled workers will be about the same as in the original population. But what is most important is that with each passing year in which the proportion of unskilled workers becomes more pronounced, until it finally levels off at its new equilibrium, more and more of the earlier immigrants have had time to achieve positions from which they can begin making contributions that raise the general standard of living. Thus, after 10 years, say, while the overall proportion of unskilled labor has risen in our hypothetical example from 50% to a little more than 52.25%, there will be immigrants who have established their own businesses and introduced important innovations, having a growing impact on the rest of the economic system and operating to raise the standard of living of everyone. And with each passing year, this effect will now become more pronounced. Thus, the effect of the change in the proportions of skilled and unskilled labor operates perhaps to postpone somewhat the restoration and increase in the standard of living of the unskilled workers. But it is difficult to see how it could substantially depress it further. At the same time, of course, it accelerates the restoration and increase in the standard of living of the skilled workers. For what happens is that while the unskilled workers, with their relatively lower wages, are unable to buy as much of the goods and services of the skilled workers are able to buy correspondingly more of the goods and services of the unskilled workers. Thus, overall, the effect of free immigration is that the immigrants enjoy a substantial gain immediately, while the original population gains after a period of time, which is shorter for skilled workers and longer for unskilled workers. Within the span of a single generation, it is likely that almost everybody has gained, and from that point on will gain more and more. For by then, the immigrants will have been making important contributions for some time, and will continue to do so, while further changes in the proportion between skilled and unskilled labor will probably have come to a halt. The fourth and final objection to the freedom of immigration that I am aware of is a non-economic argument to the effect that it means turning the country over to foreigners and thus destroying its language and culture. The fact is that for a capitalist country, the opposite is true. The freedom of immigration is the principal means of extending the language and culture of such a country. For the immigrants come voluntarily in order to take advantage of freedom and to benefit themselves. They come with the knowledge that they are coming to a better country than the one they left behind, and so are well disposed to learning its language and absorbing its culture. And because they come from many different lands, each with its own language, the language of the new country is the logical common ground for them to deal with one another. Learning it is also virtually indispensable for practical success, since almost all of the existing wealth of the country is in the hands either of its native inhabitants or of earlier immigrants who have learned the language to be able to deal with the native inhabitants. It was in just this way that English came to be the language of tens of millions of people who originally did not speak English. People who, along with learning English, made the most important parts of Anglo-Saxon culture their own, such as the idea of the rule of law and the sanctity of private property. The immigrants, of course, do not simply absorb their new country's culture. They help to make it better. They contribute to it not only their business, scientific, and artistic achievements, but, perhaps most important of all, a constantly renewed sense of personal ambition and personal achievement. They are a fresh inspiration in every generation. The fact that while 200 years ago English was the native language of perhaps 12 million people out of a world population of 1 billion, and is today the native language of well over 300 million people out of a world population of about 4 billion, is due principally to the existence of the freedom of immigration into the United States. The fact that the United States became the leading economic and military power in the world would not have been possible without its freedom of immigration, which both attracted the numbers and powerfully contributed to their per capita productivity. Had the United States adhered to the policy of free immigration, along with the rest of its freedom, it is probable that today we would have a population perhaps twice as large and a standard of living at least twice as high as the population and standard of living it presently has. As such, it would so surpass any combination of external powers as to be absolutely unassailable. I have to note that my discussion of free immigration implies the necessity of modifying an important proposition of economics, namely, the proposition that the movement of workers from lower-paying to higher-paying jobs brings about an equalization of wage rates. This proposition must be limited to a context in which the jobs are performed under similar degrees of economic freedom and cultural rationality. The movement of workers from lower-paying jobs in less free, less rational societies to higher-paying jobs in a capitalist society does not equalize wage rates, but increases the gap still further. It contributes to the emergence of virtually two different worlds. As population moves from politically created wastelands into countries in which freedom and rationality make possible continuous economic progress. I want to give a brief summary of today's lecture. I began by showing that the effect of population growth in a division of labor society is radically different than in a non-division of labor society. In a division of labor society, it means a greater, more intensive division of labor, including the larger absolute size of the various specializations and subspecializations concerned with making new discoveries and implementing them in the form of new products and better methods of production. These advantages enable a division of labor society easily to overcome any problems that would otherwise be associated with the need to produce more food and minerals for a larger population. I showed that worldwide free trade is required to achieve the largest possible market and thus the highest possible degree of division of labor consistent with the existing population of the world. I explained the role of a larger domestic free trade area in explaining the economic superiority of the United States over Western Europe and how the establishment of the common market has contributed to economic progress in Western Europe in recent decades. I also explained why, in the long run, free international trade depends on a policy of laissez-faire in the domestic economies of countries. I explained why the advantages of a larger population do not imply an economic case against birth control, in that children represent a major expense to parents. I also explained why the only thing likely to cause any problem of an excessive number of children is government intervention that shifts the expense of having them from their parents to the taxpayers. I then went on to show how the freedom of immigration in a capitalist country is to the economic self-interest of all of its inhabitants, in that it enables more talent to flourish, and thus increases the rate of economic progress in that country, through the greater operation of the pyramid of ability principle. I went on to refute the various arguments against free immigration, the argument concerning the increase in the supply of labor relative to land and natural resources, the argument concerning the increase in the supply of labor relative to capital goods, the argument concerning the increase in the supply of unskilled labor relative to skilled labor, and finally, the argument concerning the alleged danger to a country's language and culture. I showed how, in addition to its other errors previously refuted, the argument concerning land and natural resources points up the fact that the opponents of free immigration and population growth are thinking in terms of a non-division of labor society. In answer to the second argument, I showed that free immigration results in a faster rate of capital accumulation than exists without it, since it increases both the relative production of capital goods and the productivity with which capital goods are used in the production of further capital goods. In answer to the third argument, I showed how any losses of unskilled workers resulting from the decline in their wages relative to those of skilled workers was offset and then more than compensated for by the growing contributions of the immigrants to raising the standard of living of everyone. Finally, in answer to the fourth argument, using the United States as my example, I showed how the freedom of immigration increases the use of a country's language and extends the influence of its culture while greatly enriching it. I am sorry to have to end here, somewhere in the middle, but there is no alternative. I look forward to adding further lectures in the future and hope that you will want to hear them. In the meanwhile, I hope that if you have not already done so, you will read my book, The Government Against the Economy, and my essays available to you through the Intellectual Activist and the Objectivist Forum. Interjection: these essays are now available from the Jefferson School. I also hope that if you want to be able to read about many of the ideas I have discussed in these lectures, you will read the books of von Mises, principally Human Action and Socialism. He is my own principal source and inspiration in connection with most of the subjects I have discussed. Thank you.